Hi everyone, thank you for joining us on the Real Estate Funds podcast. Today we have Randy Smith from Arizona. I'm excited to have him. He spent 25 years in sales and now has gone full time into real estate, helping investors generate passive income. So excited to have Randy Smith on the show. And go ahead and introduce yourself and give a little bit about your background.
Yeah, thanks so much, Weston. You kind of hit the high level overview, but yeah, I spent 25 years in corporate America sales and sales leadership roles, primarily in very large Fortune 100, Fortune 200 organizations. First probably 10 or 12 years of my career was in an environmental services company, and I led teams of salespeople that were selling environmental services trash service to small and medium-sized businesses. And I ended up actually getting laid off from that role. And fortunately, I ended up having about a 6-month severance, so it gave me a little bit of time to find the next role. But I can tell you, it was an extremely stressful time because I did not have anything to fall back on, like I was able to finally put in place in my next tenure. So fortunately, as luck would have it, I would actually land at another great organization, had another great 10-year plus career there. But this time I took a little bit different approach to investing, and I started investing in real estate about 5 years before that second layoff or that second pink slip came. Fortunately, this time I had enough income to offset my personal expenses, so I didn't have to go back and chase the W-2 anymore. So that's kind of my short story on how I got into the space.
Cool. Well, thank you for sharing. And it seems like you started, 5 or 6 years ago by yourself, and you wanted to test the waters yourself, and now you're helping other people do the same. And so, what do you exactly provide to investors, and how do you add value to them?
Yeah, so my experience in real estate is I took the route that many people take, and I jumped in and did single family out of state rentals. As you mentioned, I'm here in Arizona, and the math just doesn't work to buy a single family here locally in cash flow. So I bought a number of houses in Kansas City. I bought a bunch more in Atlanta, and I found out very quickly that the minimal cash flow that I was getting from those investments was nowhere near what I needed to offset my W-2 income. So I started looking at bigger projects and specifically was going to buy multifamily value add, but found out very quickly that I was not skilled enough to do that. I didn't have the expertise. And it's one thing to kind of stumble your way along and figure things out when you're writing $25,000 or $50,000 checks, but when you've got $1 million, $2 million on the line for some of these assets, I decided very quickly that I needed to start investing with other folks. So I went out and I found some operators that were very well skilled in this, had high expertise, had big track records, and I started placing capital with them. And I fell in love with that syndication, passive investing space very, very quickly. And I ended up essentially selling all the single families and then putting, essentially every time I got a bonus check, I'd put another 25 or 50 grand into more deals to this point where I think I had invested in 12 or 15 deals by the time I got laid off. But I took a look and I took a step back and realized that I had actually gained some expertise in vetting operators and finding good passive investment opportunities. And everybody in my network was asking me what I was doing, how I was doing it. Why was I not stressed out of my mind looking for another job? So the thought entered my mind that maybe I'll teach other folks how to do what I did. Because historically, I've always done that. I've moved into a new role, I've gained some expertise, and then I start teaching all my peers how to do it. So this was just one more time that I did that. And my network was hungry for the type of opportunities that I was putting in front of them. And we saw quite a bit of early success. And, Impact Equity was born in June of 22. And since then, I've helped 100, I think 105 investors place a little bit over $10 million at this point across 16 different projects in commercial real estate.
Yeah, I think it was six. I think 6 million last year, maybe 6 months ago, where it was, you've grown quite a bit in the last 6 months. So yeah, you mentioned you sold your single family, and most of your money is probably in the passive space. alongside your investors. So is that one of your values, is to invest alongside your investors, you know, a significant amount of your money, so you just get alignment of interest with them?
You know, I think there's certainly something to that. And the question is often asked if the operator is heavily invested in the deals. Unfortunately, I actually invested probably too much early on and was writing too big a checks in my own deals. So 16 deals later, cash flow has not allowed me to continue investing in every deal. But I certainly put every dollar I can in the space. And I hold about 70% of my personal net worth in commercial real estate, primarily in my own deals. But there are deals, unfortunately, that I have to pass on just for cash flow reasons at this point.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you have most of your money invested alongside people, because that just makes them trust you even more. And I'm sure that that's what you mentioned to them. So yeah, you invest with different operators, you know, around the country. So what is your process for vetting different operators and the markets that they invest in?
Yeah, so it's this has been a process that's evolved quite a bit over the years. I will tell you that the first deals that I personally invested in were, I'll just share, I did not have a very good due diligence process in place. I invested with some very large operators that had very, very big brands, people that had large podcasts and big social media following. And I wrote some pretty big checks to some of those operators early on. We won't say who they are, but I'm sure you and all of your listeners know the different operators that I'm talking about, because they've got pretty big brands. So as I started to learn from that investing process, I started to learn the questions to ask in that vetting process. And a lot of it has to do with due diligence, track record, you know, what have they done in the past? Essentially, have they successfully done what they're proposing to do on this deal? And then getting into the numbers along the assumptions that they're using in their underwriting models, because underwriting is really just based on a handful of variables that you put into the tools. And that's essentially what kicks out the returns that your investors will get. So just really digging into track record, understanding the people and the operators very well, and then digging into the underwriting process. Now, I've taken an approach where I will not invest with or put my investors' capital with operators until I have a longstanding relationship with an operator. And, you know, how do I define that? Generally, it's that I've placed my own capital with them at some point. I have a good understanding of what their communications and their distributions and essentially just how they run their business over a handful of months, generally 6 to 9 months, maybe even 12 months plus. But I like to kind of linger around and watch operators for a while just to see how they show up consistently over time. I think any operator can show up really well for an investor call or maybe a presentation. But if you have multiple touch points, meet them in person, listen to their podcast, read their newsletters, talk to other people that have invested with them, then you really get to know them over time. So those are just some of the things that I'm doing at this point. And, you know, like everybody, I've got my 90 questions that I use and I go through as my checkbox to make sure I'm asking every question. But at the end of the day, you can check a lot of boxes. And if your spidey sense or your gut feeling is telling you not to invest with somebody, I listen to that. Because I've had too many times where everybody checks the box or somebody checks the box, and then for some reason I don't care for them, and inevitably the results kind of follow my gut instinct more often than not. So, and that's probably one of the benefits of spending 25 years in sales. I feel like I can figure people out pretty quickly after, you know, having thousands and thousands of face-to-face meetings with folks and phone meetings over the last 25 years.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, you mentioned 90 questions that you ask different operators. What do some of those questions include?
Yeah, so I think it's important to look at going in and exit cap rates. That tells a lot about how the underwriting is being done. If you see cap rates that are exit cap rates that are smaller significantly than the going in cap rate, that's always a big red flag. I like to dig into how, especially these days, how insurance and taxes are being calculated and where those numbers are coming from. I spend a lot of time taking a look at where are their rent comps coming from, because it's really easy to go out there and find, you know, 2015 properties and compare them to your 1980s property and show that there's a big opportunity to increase rents. But when you really look at apples to apples in that space, that's what's going to determine how successful you're going to be in raising rents. I like to dig into the track record quite a bit. I think it's interesting too, where you get a lot of folks, especially over the last 5 years or so, they had a lot of success, but they never weathered any difficult or challenging times. So I like to see folks with longer track records over, you know, sometimes multiple decades, to see that they went through 2008, to see that they maybe went through, you know, 2000, early 2000s. I like to see those kind of things. But yeah, I mean, the list kind of goes on and on and on. There's a number of different angles that we look at. And I think it's important to partner with somebody that knows what questions to ask, or at least get some guidance or direction from them.
Yeah, so you invest a lot outside of your own market in Phoenix. So what, you know, how do you analyze a market when you're not from there? You know, do you just rely upon the operator, or what's your process like there?
Yeah, it's interesting. You want to look at economic trends. So you want to look at population growth, income growth, housing growth, industry diversification. You want to look at crime levels. There's a lot that you can do and a lot of research you can do to do research on actual markets or right down to the zip code. There's a great site called city-data.com where you can really get into the weeds and take a look at all of those. And I sat through a training probably 5 years ago, where Neil Bawa walks through there's 8 different metrics that he likes to look at to determine what markets are the most feasible and the most advantageous to jump into. And, you know, at one point I actually did the research on over 80 different markets in the United States and kind of came down to a small handful of markets that I wanted to focus on. And I've gone real big on those markets since that point. So that's kind of been my process there.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you look at supply and demand too? Because, you know, there's population and job growth and also job diversification. You know, like Phoenix is pretty diversified. It's kind of an overpriced market right now. But, you know, Vegas is highly reliant upon entertainment. And I just read a market beats report, which is basically a market report from the company I work with, Cushman & Wakefield. And they analyze markets nationally. And they said that the Sun Belt markets had 3 times more multifamily development than other parts of the country. Yep. So what's your process with looking at supply and demand and kind of comparing that with the population growth and also the job growth?
Yeah, really, really good question. I think a lot of that, you know, specifically being here in Phoenix, we had a very, very large number of new starts a couple of years ago, and that's actually turning into new doors that are becoming available and impacting rents pretty significantly here in Arizona. Vegas actually got hit pretty hard. A lot of the Sun Belts did. So yeah, I mean, basic supply and demand fundamentals apply to this, just like they do, you know, any kind of market segment. And it's important to look at that. I think that the trends we're seeing now is that starts will likely start to drop off, or not starts. Starts did drop off, but actually new product coming on the market will start to drop off towards the end of this year, early next year. So we're going to see a lull again where we should see things stabilize, which should have a positive impact on our average rents. So yeah, I think it's important to look at those. The guys with the economics degrees that are watching the trends are much smarter probably than you and I, Weston. So it's important to watch those guys and follow their lead. But it's interesting. If you watch the big players, you can just kind of follow behind what they're doing and generally do very well just following the trends that you're seeing the bigger folks take. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how much do you think the new development plays in the Sun Belt? How much do you think that affects the value add, you know, Class B? You know, you go in and renovate the apartment, make it look new again. It's usually 1980s, 1990s product, or maybe early 2000s. Yep. how much do you think the new development affects those projects? Because the new development is brand new and, you know, a lot more expensive. They're probably offering concessions at the moment. Yep. How does that affect your investments?
Yeah, so I think it absolutely has an impact. I was not quite sure the impact that it would have. Rewind a couple of years. I didn't think it was going to have as big of an impact as it has had, and the economists all suggested that it would. So obviously, if you have A-class property that is doing rents at $3,000, but they're offering 6 or 8 weeks of concessions, it's not too difficult to do the calculation to see average rent per month starts to get into the range that's very close to the high B-plus or A-minus asset classes. So that does trickle down all the way down, I would suggest, even down into the C-class, because it is there is more doors that are coming on the market, which do impact everybody. And I think they're impacting much more than I initially thought they would, but I think we'll start to see that soften here in the coming months.
Yeah. Yeah, what does your underwriting process look like? Because you've vet the operator, you have your checklist there. What does your process look like for evaluating the deal as a whole?
Yeah, so I have underwriting. I will share is not my strength. I have a tendency to partner with people that are very good underwriters, and or I will actually leverage third party underwriters for the deals that I'm doing. So. Over the last handful of years, I've become somewhat skilled in the space, but I still want to get another set of eyes on those. But generally, it comes down to taking a look at the assumptions that are used in the underwriting model. What are the, year one rent growth, and what do those look like over the course of the 3 to 5 year hold? What's going on with expenses? What's going on with interest and taxes? Additional where you see a lot of interesting things, and I spent a lot of time on this today, is looking at additional income streams that are in underwriting models. It's I think people can get they paint a pretty rosy picture when they start talking about additional income that they're expecting to experience, and then when you actually take a look at where they are 3, 6, 12 months down the road, quite often it's nowhere near what their underwriting is. So I think those are all important pieces that you got to take a look at. I think also just calling comps and making sure that they're using the right comps is really important. I saw a deck today where we saw their rental comps on late 1980s. They were using 2015 rental comps. And I don't care how well you're renovating those units, you're not going to turn a 1986 into a 2015. You just can't do it. So I think those are all important things you got to look at.
Yeah. Yeah, tell us about the deals you're raising for right now and the different funds you have.
Yeah. Yeah, so I am raising for actually by the time this airs, I probably won't be raising for it because we've had like really, really huge interest in this deal. It's a group by, or it's a project by ATX Acquisitions. They've got over 80 full cycle deals going back to the mid-2010s. These guys have been in place and just been rock stars for a long time. It's in Jacksonville, Florida. I would call it a B-class asset that we're trying to bring up to probably B-plus. And it actually has in-place rents that are significantly lower than what the renovated units are today. So great comps. We've got a really good business plan put in place, and we're getting assumable loan on this. So we will have interest only for, I think, 7 or 10 months out of the first year. And we're bringing in some pref equity, so the returns that we're providing our investors are hands down the best returns I have seen in all of my time in this space. So really excited to be partnering with ATX and ResProp, who is their in-house property management group. So got a beautiful multifamily 506C for accredited investors. And then I launched earlier this year a debt fund in answer to my investors looking for a place to park their capital with liquidity and still getting better returns than what they might be able to get in a high yield savings account or a money market account. So I partnered with a group called DLP Capital, who is a very large multifamily operator. They started as fix and flippers in the residential space and gradually grew into very high-end luxury fix and flip, and then small multifamily, then large multifamily, then development. And they, throughout that whole process, they also lent to that their peers, essentially, in the markets where they work. So they are lending to fix and flippers and small multifamily and very large multifamily operators, and we're able to provide our investors over 8.25% return on a monthly basis, 8.25% annualized on a monthly basis, and it has a 90-day liquidity option. So one of the big objections that newer investors in the space have is that their dollars are tied up for 3 to 5 years. So this is a really good option for folks to place some capital into a liquid investment and still get almost twice as what they could expect to get if they're in a money market or a high yield savings account. And then lastly, I've got, I'm working with TechVestor. As you know, if you follow me on LinkedIn, you've seen my short-term rental houses that I do in partnership with TechVestor. And we're buying, I think we're at 140 residential homes that are used being rented on Airbnb and other markets. And these are very, I wouldn't say very high-end, but very highly amenitized mid-range homes that just create amazing renter experience. So that's been a lot of fun. It's a cash flow play, but a pretty heavy equity multiple as well. So between the three, we're really talking and fitting the needs of a number of different types of investors.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think is the risk to reward in all those funds? I know the debt fund's probably less risk. But what's your opinion on the risk reward ratio? Because I'm curious about the Airbnb fund. You know, I've raised for 3 multifamily properties, and just curious to hear what the risk is there.
Yeah, so I think they all have risks. And you hit the nail on the head. Certainly, the debt fund is the least risky of those options because it's liquid. If you see something going in the wrong direction, you just request a redemption, and you have your money. You know, usually on average within a couple of weeks. But, you know, we publicly market 90 days because that's how our contract's written. The short-term rental one is kind of an interesting one. It is, if you see the pictures, the renovations that we're doing on these, they're very heavily renovated and geared towards the short-term rental market. So it's probably not an asset if for some reason we needed to liquidate assets that would sell to the traditional home buyer. The exit plan for that asset class is either to private equity or REIT or potentially large short-term rental operators that want to increase their portfolio size. So it's likely a little more risky than a multifamily value add deal because the value add is done through the business model of creating these very unique and specific type of assets. So I think short-term rental is likely a little bit more risky. And because of that, we have significantly higher cash flow to the point where we're probably going to be at 10% cash on cash before we're halfway through year two on this. So significantly higher cash on cash with the same or better equity multiple that you might expect to get through a multifamily offering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how's that fund structured? Is it open-ended? You know, investors can come in and out at any time. Not in and out at any time, but you know, they invest now and get access to the previous deals that TechVestor has done. And how does that work exactly?
Yeah, so an investor today would get access to all of the assets and the gains of all of the assets in Fund 2. We launched Fund 2 in, I think it was January of 2023. And this one will likely stay open through the end of 2024. So investor A, who invested in January, their preferred return started accruing the day they invested. And each quarter, we pay out distributions based on when those dollars came in. So investors in our first tranche are getting significantly higher returns because they've been in the fund much longer. It is, to a certain extent, a blind fund because we don't identify the assets on the front end. But we have very clearly identified what type of assets we're buying in what markets, and it's less blind. The beautiful thing with what TechVestor is doing is their two folks that came from a technology background. So they're really integrating technology with real estate, and they're analyzing thousands of properties. And as they raise more capital, they buy the absolute best properties that they can turn into their ideal type of investment and customer experience, renter experience. And every time they're buying a new one and collecting more data on their usage, the results just seem to be getting better and better every time. So,
So do you raise a new fund each year with them?
No. So the fund I launched in March of last year, it was initially written to close at the end of last year, but they made the choice to extend that into the end of 2024 versus doing a new fund every year. And there's a legal process where we add an addendum and inform all of the investors. But it's still an open fund. We'll be raising through the end of the year. And then it's a pro forma 4 to 6 year hold period.
4 to 6 years. Got it. Yeah. And then what about the debt fund? What types of loans are you guys giving out, and how does the risk reward work there?
Yeah, it's kind of unique. The this particular fund, he's doing $200,000 fix and flip loans all the way up to $30 million multifamily repositioning loans. So it's really interesting to watch how they underwrite their deals. They have a group that has become, it's kind of like an inner circle where they have actually trained these operators on how to run their business. They've become a part of their, what they call an elite organization, which Don Winter is the CEO of DLP, and just amazing operator. So it's a small group of operators that they have very strong, long-lasting relationships with, and they only work with operators that operate in their markets where they already operate, and they will only lend on assets that they are willing to take over if for some reason the loan were to go bad. And this particular loan, this particular offering has been in place for almost 10 years now, and the fund has never lost a single dollar of interest income or principal return. So it's a very, very impressive group. I would say probably the least risky of any deal I've ever seen. And the redemption period just makes it really attractive because it's almost as easy as keeping dollars actually easier than a CD, but certainly almost as easy as being in like a high yield savings account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you get preferred terms with them, you know, better terms for investors and also yourself because you bring a certain amount to the table? Or I know their minimums are kind of high. It might be 200,000. I looked at it a while back, but yeah, just tell us about, you know, how you make money from this. And, you know, I think it's 8.25% that investors get, which is really good. So tell us how that works.
Yeah. So one of the biggest, and it kind of going back to why I formed Impact Equity, I truly believe that traditional retail investors need to have access to these type of deals. And with DLP specifically, they have a $200,000 minimum investment, and they are likely going to be increasing that to $500,000 by the end of this year. So the traditional retail investor who has, you know, maybe 100, 200 grand is not likely going to be able to participate in something like this. So I created this fund with a $25,000 minimum, just like all of my deals. All of them have $25,000 minimums because I think that makes this available to the average retail investor in this space. Now, I don't do this just for a hobby. I need to make a few dollars on this. So I do charge what I call it's a 1% due diligence fee. So if somebody invests $100,000, I make personally $1,000 on the front end. And then every month as we get our distributions, our preferred return and our equity returns, we hold back 15% of the returns. So the fund is earning, this last month, it was 10.29%. And our investors will get almost 8.5%. So essentially 85% of the fund's earnings. And if you do the math real quickly on that, we're not making a lot of money. But I thought it was important to make this available to our investor base because there is an interest and there's a demand. And I think it's the right thing. Personally, I hold, a certain percentage of my dollars in this fund, so it's liquid. I do still hold some money in a high yield savings account for extremely liquid needs that I have. And then another portion in a little bit more risky investments, and then the very large majority in multifamily value add.
Yeah, what are your plans moving forward?
Yeah, so it just kind of builds upon that goal from the day we launched it. So my goal is to offer diversification to my investors. I want to be a one-stop shop for the newer passive investor, and I want to give them diversification across asset classes, geographies, operators, business plan, and risk-reward investment offerings. So that's the goal. I'm constantly looking to have between four and five of the best world-class operators across multiple asset classes to where I can put a deal in front of my investors, call it every 45 days or so. So that's the main goal for Impact Equity. I've had, as I mentioned to you before, kind of my passion has always been like becoming good at something and then teaching other people how to do it. So I'm teaching other people how to do what I've done with Impact Equity now. And yeah, I'll just continue to grow on both angles there.
Cool. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing all that information, Randy. Some valuable lessons to be taken from there. Just a couple of questions to wrap up. What's your favorite investing book?
Favorite investing book. So, everybody says Brian Burke's Hands Off Investor, which I think is a fantastic book. I'm reading now Charlie Munger's Almanac because I'm really getting into Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and I'm really enjoying that. And actually, I like a lot of parables as well. So anytime you see, goodness, I can't think of the name of the book now. Anyways, there's a number of parables out there that offer great investing advice, and I will always enjoy listening to one of those as well.
Yeah, and it's cool how you can apply different investing advice because Warren Buffett, he's in stocks and you can also his lessons to real estate, which is cool.
Absolutely. Yep.
Last question, what's your number one piece of advice for a passive investor?
That's a tough question. I think if I were to go based on my own experience, I would say probably the biggest piece of advice I'd give myself 10 years ago is just get started. And I like this phrase, like you cannot steer a parked car. If you sit on the sidelines and try to have every single piece of information before you make your first investment, you'll never make your first investment. So I say do as good a due diligence as you possibly can. Take a piece of your investable capital and place it in an investment immediately. And I think you'd be really glad that you did.
Cool. Well, thank you for joining us, Randy. I'm glad we could host you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Weston. It's a lot of fun.